A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
You wake up, look at the list, and the list is longer than the hours you have. You work every second, fall into bed, and the next morning the list is still longer than the hours. That moment when you realize working harder isn't the answer. That's where Daniel is right now.
Moving an apartment with a 1-year-old, no family nearby, unfurnished place. This isn't a productivity problem. It's a scale mismatch. The project is structurally bigger than the time two adults can give it, and that's just the math. There's no life hack that makes a 60-hour project fit into a 20-hour week.
And Daniel's question is what happens after you accept the math? He's been running at full speed for weeks, maybe 2 months, and he's hit the wall where Go Harder stops working. He wants to know how to adapt, how to be okay with making 1% progress in a day, and actually taking rest without feeling like you're failing. That's the core tension, right? The rest feels like failure, even when it's the only thing that'll keep you going.
And he's asking as someone whose brain, by his own description, is wired for all or nothing. Get it done fast, knock off the list, wrap the project. When the project won't wrap, that wiring becomes a liability. It's like having a car that only does 0 or 120 miles an hour, and now you need to drive through a residential zone for 6 weeks. The engine's not built for it. So the question is, what's the third path between burning out and giving up?
Let's trace it in order. First, why this feels so awful even when you're working constantly. The neuroscience of why your brain registers constant effort as failure. Then what acceptance actually means as a skill, not a surrender. Then the practical stuff Daniel can use tomorrow morning.
So why does a project like moving an apartment feel so overwhelming even when you're working nonstop? The answer starts in your prefrontal cortex, the part of your brain that's trying to be the project manager for this whole operation.
Your prefrontal cortex can hold roughly 3 to 5 chunks of information at once. That's it. Nelson Cowan nailed this down in 2010. It's one of the most replicated findings in cognitive psychology. 3 to 5 chunks. Not 3 to 5 projects. Not 3 to 5 rooms. 3 to 5 discrete pieces of information, total, at any given moment.
And a move involves, let me actually count this out, sourcing furniture, assembling furniture, cleaning the old place, cleaning the new place, setting up utilities, unpacking boxes, organizing rooms, managing a toddler's schedule, feeding everyone, handling the paperwork for the old lease, the new lease, address changes, internet installation, finding where you pack the coffee maker.
That's already more than 5, and I didn't even get to the kitchen stuff.
Right, so the brain can't hold the full picture. What it does instead is collapse the whole thing into a simplified mental model. I need to do everything right now. That's not a thought you have, it's a background pressure. A constant low-grade alarm that never shuts off. And here's the thing about that alarm. It's not giving you useful information. It's just screaming, incomplete, at all times, regardless of what you actually did today.
And when the brain treats everything as a single, undifferentiated blob, any progress you make feels invisible. You assembled 3 pieces of furniture today. The blob is still enormous. The brain registers that as failure because it's comparing against the blob, not against what was actually possible. It's like trying to empty the ocean with a bucket. You can bail water for 12 hours straight, and the ocean looks exactly the same. Your brain says nothing changed, but you moved thousands of gallons. You just can't see it against the scale of the whole.
This is where ADHD amplifies everything Daniel described. Individuals with ADHD have reduced working memory capacity compared to neurotypical controls, and a much stronger tendency toward all-or-nothing thinking patterns. When the brain perceives a task list as effectively infinite, it triggers task paralysis, that freeze response that looks like procrastination but is actually cognitive overload. The system just stalls.
But Daniel's not freezing. That's the interesting wrinkle here. He's doing the opposite. He's been working around the clock for weeks. That's a counterphobic response. You try to outrun the overwhelm with sheer velocity. Instead of the freeze response, you get the flight response. Except you're not fleeing the project. You're fleeing the feeling of being overwhelmed by attacking the project non-stop.
And it works beautifully for finite projects. A paper due Friday, a presentation on Monday, you can sprint, finish, collapse. The dopamine hit of completion is right there, just a few days away. But a multi-week move has almost no natural completion signals. You don't get a little burst of reward when you've unpacked box 7 of 40. The brain interprets the lack of reward as, well, as failure. Which fuels more frantic effort? You're running harder on a treadmill that doesn't have a stop button.
This is the dopamine trap. Fast, completable tasks give small dopamine hits. That little yes-done feeling. Daniel's system, work as hard and fast as possible to get things done, is built around those hits. His brain has been trained on a diet of completions, but the moving project is a dopamine desert. There are very few clean finish lines. So he's running harder and harder trying to find a finish line that keeps receding. And the harder he runs, the more depleted his dopamine system gets, and the worse he feels, which makes him run harder. It's a vicious cycle.
And stopping feels like giving up. That's the key emotional mechanism here. The compulsion to work every waking second isn't about effectiveness. It's about avoiding the feeling of surrender. If I stop, I've admitted defeat. If I keep going, at least I'm fighting. There's a moral weight attached to the effort. Rest becomes morally suspect.
Which is where acceptance comes in. And I want to be careful with that word, because in productivity conversations, it often sounds like giving up. It's not. Acceptance isn't resignation. It's not, I guess I'll just live in chaos forever. It's something much more active.
There's a really solid meta-analysis from 2019 in Clinical Psychology Review. 23 studies looking at acceptance-based interventions for burnout and task persistence. They found acceptance-based approaches reduced emotional exhaustion by about half a standard deviation, Cohen's D of 0.47, which is a meaningful real-world effect. These aren't people who stopped caring. These are people who got better at accurately calibrating their expectations to reality so they could make sustainable choices. They didn't lower their standards. They aligned their standards with what was actually possible.
So acceptance as an active skill. You look at the project honestly and say, this will take X more weeks. I can realistically do Y tasks per day given the baby and the sleep deprivation and everything else. That's the math. Once you accept the math, you stop fighting reality and start working with it. You go from why isn't this done yet to, okay, given where we are, what's the best use of the next hour?
The alternative is fighting reality, and reality always wins that fight. Always. You just exhaust yourself first, and then reality wins anyway. The only question is whether you arrive at the finish line functional or completely depleted.
Daniel said he's at phase two. He's accepted that the project is bigger than the time he can devote to it. He sees the math, but the question he's really asking is, how do I operationalize that acceptance? How do I actually live inside it day to day without feeling like I'm failing every time I stop working?
So we know why it hurts. The real question is, what do you actually do about it? Let's get practical.
The first thing is redefining what progress means. Daniel's current measure is tasks completed, and that's the natural measure for someone who likes knocking things off a list. It's satisfying. But for a project this size, task completed is a terrible metric. You can complete 15 tasks in a day and still feel like you lost ground because the remaining list is so long. The metric is lying to you.
What researchers call effort-based goal pursuit. Instead of measuring by output, measure by time spent in a sustainable zone. Did I work at a pace I can maintain tomorrow? Did I take the break I scheduled? Those become the wins. The win isn't, I finished the living room. The win is, I worked for 2 hours at a sustainable pace and then I stopped when I said I'd stop.
Which leads to the first practical tactic, and this one is specifically designed for the ADHD all-or-nothing wiring, the 1% rule.
Define a minimum viable daily progress target so small it feels almost trivial. Assemble one piece of furniture, or unpack one box, or make one phone call. One thing, that's the day's win. Everything else is above the line.
The target has to be genuinely tiny. Not make progress on the living room. That's vague and hard to check off. One box. One screwdriver task. Something you can finish in 10 minutes or less.
Here's why this works neurologically. The all-or-nothing brain needs a completion signal. It needs to register done, or it feels like the day was wasted. That's the dopamine system talking. By setting a target so small that failure is almost impossible, you guarantee that completion signal every single day. You get your dopamine hit. And then, this is the key, you let yourself exceed it without pressure. The target is the floor, not the ceiling.
Some days you'll do the one box, and that's it. And that day is a success. Some days you'll do the one box and then keep going for 3 hours because you've got momentum. Also a success. Both are good days. The only bad day is the day you set the target and finish everything and then crash. That's the day the system failed you.
Daniel's been working around the clock for weeks. His brain has learned that effort equals endless grind with no completion reward. That's a punishing association. The 1% rule retrains that. It says effort leads to completion every single day guaranteed. Over time, that rebuilds the association between work and satisfaction instead of work and depletion. You're literally rewiring the reward pathway.
And this isn't just feel-good advice. There's a reason behavioral activation therapy for depression uses exactly this approach. Tiny, achievable goals that rebuild the sense of agency. The brain needs to experience. I did the thing, and it mattered, to stay motivated. If it never gets that experience, motivation collapses.
Second tactic, scheduled stepping away. And I mean scheduled, on the list, non-negotiable, protected from guilt. This is not take a break when you've earned it. This is take a break because it's part of the system.
And I know Daniel's going to push back on this internally. The voice that says, I can't stop, there's too much to do. So let's talk about what's actually happening in the brain when you don't take breaks.
There's a 2022 study in Nature Human Behavior that found something remarkable. 2 minutes of nature exposure, even just looking at a photo of a tree, restored directed attention capacity by 18% compared to looking at urban scenes. 2 minutes.
18%?
18%. From 2 minutes of looking at a tree. The mechanism is that directed attention is a limited resource. When you're constantly task switching, assemble this, find that box, where's the screwdriver, the baby needs something, what's for dinner, you're depleting it continuously. Brief periods of deliberate disengagement restore it. It's not rest as a luxury, it's rest as a cognitive refueling stop.
And deliberate is the operative word. Scrolling your phone isn't disengagement. Your phone is an attention demand, not a break. It's serving you more things to process. What works is walking, staring out a window, doing something physical and simple like washing a few dishes by hand, something that lets your mind drift without demanding it. Focus on anything in particular.
Even 5 to 10 minutes produces a measurable restoration of working memory capacity, on the order of 15 to 20% recovery. That's not woo-woo self-care language. That's cognitive physiology. You're literally getting dumber as the day goes on if you don't take breaks, and then you're making worse decisions about the very project you're trying to complete.
The hard part for Daniel is going to be the guilt. When there's still so much to do, stepping away feels irresponsible. It feels like slacking. But the research says the opposite. Not stepping away is what's irresponsible. You're making worse decisions, moving slower, and burning out faster without those breaks.
Put the break on the to-do list, literally write it down. 10 minutes, sit on the balcony, no phone. Check it off when you do it. That makes it a task, not an absence of tasks. For a brain that needs completion signals, checking off, took my break, is useful. It reframes the break as something you did, not something you failed to avoid.
Third tactic, externalize the project map. Get it out of your head entirely.
This directly addresses the working memory bottleneck we talked about. Daniel is holding the entire project in his head, every room, every task, everything that still needs doing. That's not just stressful, it's cognitively expensive. Every bit of working memory that's occupied by don't forget to call the electrician is memory that's not available for actually doing the task in front of you. You're using your brain as a storage device, and it's a terrible storage device.
Think of it like your computer's RAM. If you've got 30 browser tabs open, the thing you're actually trying to do runs slower. Externalizing the list is closing the tabs. It frees up processing power for the task at hand.
Write down every remaining task. Physical whiteboard, simple digital list, doesn't matter, but keep it simple. This isn't the time to adopt a complex productivity system with tags and priorities and color coding. The goal is just to get the fog out of your head and onto a surface you can see.
The act of externalizing does two things. First, it reduces the constant low-grade anxiety of what am I forgetting? If it's on the board, you're not forgetting it. That background anxiety just quiets down. Second, it makes the project feel finite again. It's a list. It has a bottom. You can see it. The blob becomes a list, and a list is manageable.
Daniel said the move happened quickly at the end of the tenancy, and they've been in reactive mode ever since. A visible list turns reactive chaos into something you can actually sequence. You can look at the board and say, okay, today the kitchen corner, tomorrow the bedroom closet. You're making choices instead of just responding to whatever feels most urgent. Urgency is a terrible prioritization system. It just hands control of your day to whatever is screaming loudest.
The fourth piece, and this one is specific to Daniel's situation, is the parenting variable. A one-year-old creates unpredictable interruptions that fragment attention. Ezra isn't going to respect your deep work block.
Nor should he. He's one.
The adaptation here is to stop expecting deep work blocks and embrace what some researchers call micro-productivity. 5 to 10 minute bursts between childcare tasks. Baby's occupied with a toy for 8 minutes. You unpack half a box. Baby goes down for a nap. You assemble one chair. You don't try to carve out 2 uninterrupted hours because they won't happen, and trying to force them just creates frustration on top of everything else.
This actually aligns surprisingly well with the ADHD brain's natural rhythm. Hyperfocus for a short burst, then reset. The problem is when you expect the hyperfocus to last 4 hours and it doesn't, and then you feel like you failed. 10-minute burst with resets in between. That's a sustainable rhythm that works with your brain instead of against it.
Hannah is in this too. They're a team of two with no family support nearby. The micro-productivity approach means they can hand off. One parent takes Ezra for 20 minutes, the other knocks out 3 micro-tasks, then they switch. Neither person gets a 4-hour block, but both people make progress. And crucially, both people get breaks.
Daniel said he and Hannah both like to knock things off a list and wrap projects quickly. That shared instinct is probably making this harder for both of them. They're both watching the other person struggle with the same impossible standard. They're both feeling the same guilt about not being done yet. It's like two people drowning next to each other, each trying to save the other, while also trying to stay afloat.
One thing that helps, name the standard out loud together. Say we aren't going to finish this week. We're going to hit our 1% today, and then we're going to sit down and eat dinner. Making it explicit between partners takes it out of the realm of private guilt and makes it a shared strategy. Now it's not, I failed today. It's, we agreed today's target was reasonable and we hit it.
Let me pull those tactics into something you can actually remember and use tomorrow morning.
Go for it.
Tactic 1, the 1% rule. Define a minimum viable daily target so small it feels trivial. 1 box, 1 phone call, 1 piece of furniture. That you win. Everything else is bonus. This guarantees a completion signal every day and bypasses the all-or-nothing trap.
Tactic 2. Scheduled rest isn't a reward for progress. It's a prerequisite for cognitive function. 5 to 10 minutes of deliberate disengagement. Walking, window gazing, something physical and simple, restores working memory by 15 to 20%. Put it on the list. Check it off. The break is a task you complete, not a failure you succumb to.
Tactic 3. Externalize. Get every remaining task out of your head and onto a whiteboard or a simple list. This reduces cognitive load, kills the background anxiety of, what am I forgetting, and makes the project feel finite again. You can see the bottom. You can sequence.
The parenting adaptation. Embrace micro-productivity. 10-minute bursts. Hand off with your partner. Stop expecting uninterrupted deep work and work with the rhythm you actually have. The baby sets the schedule. You work around it rather than fighting it.
Underneath all of these is the acceptance piece Daniel already identified. Acceptance isn't lowering your standards. It's accurately calibrating them to reality so you can make sustainable choices. The math is the math. This will take X more weeks. You can do Y per day. Fighting the math doesn't change the math, it just exhausts you. And exhausted people make worse decisions, which makes the project take even longer.
The thing about acceptance as a skill is that it's transferable. Daniel's got a few more weeks of this move, but the pattern shows up everywhere. Work projects, creative work, parenting itself. Any project where the scope dwarfs your capacity triggers the same all-or-nothing response. Learning to do the 1% rule and scheduled rest and externalization during the move means you've got those tools for the next thing. You're not just surviving the move, you're building a skill set.
Redefine what a good day looks like. A good day isn't the day you finish everything. A good day is the day you hit your minimum target and took a real break. The break isn't optional, it's part of the system. It's as important as the unpacking.
I keep coming back to that nature-human behavior finding. 2 minutes looking at a tree, not even a real tree, a photo, restores 18% of your directed attention. The brain isn't a machine, it's a biological system with limits. Respecting the limits isn't weakness. It's the only way to sustain effort over weeks and months. The machine that never stops is the machine that breaks.
Daniel said he's been working around the clock for weeks, if not months. That's not sustainable for anyone, ADHD or not. The goal isn't to become a machine that never stops. The goal is to become someone who can sustain effort over the long haul without breaking. That's a different kind of strength, and it's learnable. And honestly, it's a rarer and more valuable kind of strength than just grinding yourself into dust.
The cutting room floor detail I keep thinking about, that 2019 analysis didn't just find that acceptance reduced burnout. It found that the effect was strongest in exactly the kind of situation Daniel is in. High-demand contexts where the person has limited control over the total workload. You can't make the move smaller, but you can change how you relate to it. And that change in relationship is what determines whether you arrive at the finish line functional or completely wrecked.
If you're in the middle of something that feels too big, and Daniel, I know you're listening while probably assembling something, try the 1% rule today. Pick one tiny thing, do it, then stop. See how it feels to have a day where you hit your target and took a break. That's the adaptation. That's the third path.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumintop, for keeping this show running.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want to send us your own question, moving related or otherwise, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.